You need not go far. Nervously, Danny gathered the reins in her hands and slid her feet into the short stirrups. She was only a fair rider. She had spent far more time travelling by ship and wagon and palanquin than by horseback. Praying she would not fall off and disgrace herself, she gave the filly the lightest and most timid touch with her knees. And for the first time in hours, she forgot to be afraid. Or perhaps it was the first time ever. The silver-grey filly moved with a smooth and silken gait, and the crowd parted for her, every eye upon them. Danny found herself moving faster than she had intended, yet somehow it was exciting rather than terrifying. The horse broke into a trot, and she smiled. Dothraki scrambled to clear a path. The slightest pressure with her legs, the lightest touch on the reins, and the filly responded. She sent it into a gallop, and now the Dothraki were hooting and laughing and shouting at her as they jumped out of her way. As she turned to ride back, a fire pit loomed ahead, directly in her path. They were hemmed in on either side, with no room to stop. A daring she had never known filled Daenerys then, and she gave the filly her head. The silver horse leaped the flames as if she had wings. When she pulled up before Magister Illyrio, she said, "Tell Khal Drogo that he has given me the wind." The fat Pentoshi stroked his yellow beard as he repeated the words in Dothraki, and Danny saw her new husband smile for the first time. The last sliver of sun vanished behind the high walls of Pentos to the west just then. Danny had lost all track of time. Khal Drogo commanded his blood riders to bring forth his own horse, a lean, red stallion. As the Khal was saddling the horse, Viserys slid close to Danny on her silver, dug his fingers into her leg and said, "Please him, sweet sister, or I swear you will see the dragon wake as it has never woken before." The fear came back to her then, with her brother's words. She felt like a child once more, only 13 and all alone, not ready for what was about to happen to her. They rode out together as the stars came out, leaving the Khalasar and the grass palaces behind. Khal Drogo spoke no word to her, but drove his stallion at a hard trot through the gathering dusk. The tiny silver bells in his long braid rang softly as he rode. "I am the blood of the dragon," she whispered aloud as she followed, trying to keep her courage up. "I am the blood of the dragon. I am the blood of the dragon." The dragon was never afraid. Afterwards, she could not say how far or how long they had ridden, but it was full dark when they stopped at a grassy place beside a small stream. Drogo swung off his horse and lifted her down from hers. She felt as fragile as glass in his hands, her limbs as weak as water. She stood there helpless and trembling in her wedding silks while he secured the horses, and when he turned to look at her, she began to cry. Khal Drogo stared at her tears, his face strangely empty of expression. "No," he said. He lifted his hand and rubbed away the tears roughly with a callous thumb. "You speak the common tongue?" Danny said in wonder. "No," he said again. Perhaps he had only that word, she thought, but it was one word more than she had known he had, and somehow it made her feel a little better. Drogo touched her hair lightly, sliding the silver blonde strands between his fingers and murmuring softly in Dothraki. Danny did not understand the words, yet there was a warmth in his tone, a tenderness she had never expected from this man. He put his finger on her chin and lifted her head, so she was looking up into his eyes. Drogo towered over her as he towered over everyone. Taking her lightly under the arms, he lifted her and seated her on a rounded rock beside the stream. Then he sat on the ground facing her, legs crossed beneath him, their faces finally at a height. "No," he said. "Is that the only word you know?" she asked him. Drogo did not reply. His long, heavy braid was coiled in the dirt beside him. He pulled it over his right shoulder and began to remove the bells from his hair, one by one. After a moment, Danny leaned forward to help. When they were done, Drogo gestured. She understood. Slowly, carefully, she began to undo his braid. It took a long time. All the while, he sat there silently, watching her. When she was done, he shook his head, and his hair spread out behind him like a river of darkness, oiled and gleaming. She had never seen hair so long, so black, so thick. Then it was his turn. He began to undress her. His fingers were deft and strangely tender. He removed her silks one by one, carefully, while Danny sat unmoving, silent, looking at his eyes. When he bared her small breasts, she could not help herself. She averted her eyes and covered herself with her hands. "No," Drogo said. He pulled her hands away from her breasts gently but firmly, then lifted her face again to make her look at him. "No," he repeated. "No," she echoed back at him. He stood her up then and pulled her close to remove the last of her silks. The night air was chilly on her bare skin. She shivered, and goose flesh covered her arms and legs. She was afraid of what would come next. But for a while, nothing happened. Khal Drogo sat with his legs crossed, looking at her, drinking in her body with his eyes. After a while, he began to touch her, lightly at first, then harder. She could sense a fierce strength in his hands, but he never hurt her. He held her hand in his own and brushed her fingers one by one. He ran a hand gently down her leg. He stroked her face, tracing the curve of her ears, running a finger gently around her mouth. He put both hands in her hair and combed it with his fingers. He turned her around, massaged her shoulders, slid a knuckle down the path of her spine. It seemed as if hours passed before his hands finally went to her breasts. He stroked the soft skin underneath until it tingled. He circled her nipples with his thumbs, pinched them between thumb and forefinger, then began to pull at her, very lightly at first, then more insistently, until her nipples stiffened and began to ache. He stopped then and drew her down onto his lap. Danny was flushed and breathless, a heart fluttering in her chest. He cupped her face in his huge hands and looked into her eyes. "No," he said, and she knew it was a question. She took his hand and moved it down to the wetness between her thighs. "Yes," she whispered, as she put his finger inside her. Eddard. The summons came in the hour before the dawn, when the world was still and grey. Alan shook him roughly from his dreams, and Ned stumbled into the pre-dawn chill, groggy from sleep, to find his horse saddled and the king already mounted. Robert wore thick brown gloves and a heavy fur cloak, with a hood that covered his ears and looked for all the world like a bear sitting on a horse. "Up, Stark," he rode. "Up, up. We have matters of state to discuss." "By all means," Ned said. "Come inside, Your Grace." Alan lifted the flap of the tent. "No, no, no," Robert said, his breath steam with every word. "The camp is full of ears. Besides, I want to ride out and taste this country of yours." Sir Boris and Sir Merrin waited behind him with a dozen guardsmen Ned saw. There was nothing to do but rub the sleep from his eyes, dress, and mount up. Robert set the pace, driving his huge black destrier hard, as Ned galloped along beside him, trying to keep up. He called out a question as they rode, but the wind blew his words away, and the king did not hear him. After that, Ned rode in silence. They soon left the king's road, and took off across rolling plains dark with mist. By then the guard had fallen back a small distance, safely out of earshot, but still Robert would not slow. Dawn broke as they crested a low ridge, and finally the king pulled up. By then they were miles south of the main party. Robert was flushed and exhilarated as Ned reined up beside him.
"Guards," he swore, laughing, "it feels good to get out and ride the way a man was meant to ride. I swear, Ned, this creeping along is enough to drive a man mad."
He had never been a patient man, Robert Baratheon.
"That damnable wheelhouse, the way it creaks and groans, climbing every bump in the road as if it were a mountain. I promise you, if that wretched thing breaks another axle, I'm going to burn it, and Cersei can walk."
Ned laughed.
"I will gladly light the torch for you." "Good man," the king clapped him on the shoulder. "I've half a mind to leave them all behind and just keep going."
A smile touched Ned's lips. "I do believe you mean it."
"I do, I do," the king said. "What do you say, Ned? Just you and me. Two vagabond knights on the king's road. Our swords at our sides, and the gods know what in front of us, and maybe a farmer's daughter or a tavern wench to warm our beds tonight."
"Would that we could," Ned said. "But we have duties now, my liege, to the realm, to our children, I to my lady wife, and you to your queen. We are not the boys we were."
You never were the boy you were," Robert grumbled. "More's a pity. And yet, there was that one time, eh? What was her name? That common girl of yours, Becca? No, she was one of mine. God's lover, black hair and those sweet big eyes, you could drown in them. Yours was, Alina? No. You told me once, was it, Meryl? You know the one I mean, your bastard's mother."
"Her name was Willa," Ned replied with cool courtesy, "and I would sooner not speak of her."
"Willa, yes," the king grinned. "She must have been a rare wench if she could make Lord Eddard Stark forget his honour even for an hour. You never told me what she looked like."
Ned's mouth tightened in anger. "Nor will I. Leave it be, Robert, for the love you say you bear me. I dishonoured myself, and I dishonoured Catelyn, in the sight of gods and men."
"Oh, gods have mercy, you scarcely knew Catelyn."
"I had taken her to wife. She was carrying my child."
"You're too hard on yourself, Ned. You always were. Damn it, no woman wants Baelor the Blessed in her bed."
He slapped a hand on his knee.
"Well, I'll not press you if you feel so strong about it. Though I swear at times you're so prickly you ought to take the hedgehog as your sigil."
The rising sun sent fingers of light through the pale white mists of dawn. A wide plain spread out beneath them, bare and brown, its flatness here and there relieved by long, low hummocks. Ned pointed them out to the king. "The barrows of the first men." Robert frowned.
"Have we ridden on to a graveyard?"
"There are barrows everywhere in the north, your grace," Ned told him. "This land is old."
"And cold," Robert grumbled, pulling his cloak more tightly around himself.
The guard had reined up well behind them at the bottom of the ridge.
"Well, I did not bring you out here to talk of graves or bicker about your bastard. There was a rider in the night from Lord Varys in King's Landing. Here."
The king pulled a paper from his belt and handed it to Ned. Varys, the eunuch, was the king's master of whisperers. He served Robert now, as he had once served Aerys Targaryen. Ned unrolled the paper with trepidation, thinking of Lysa and her terrible accusation. But the message did not concern Lady Aerin. "What is the source for this information?"
"Do you remember Sir Jorah Mormont?"
"Would that I might forget him," Ned said bluntly. The Mormonts of Bear Island were an old house, proud and honourable, but their lands were cold and distant and poor. Sir Jorah had tried to swell the family coffers by selling some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver. As the Mormonts were bannermen to the Starks, his crime had dishonored the North. Ned had made the long journey west to Bear Island, only to find when he arrived that Jorah had taken ship beyond the reach of ice and the king's justice. 5 years had passed since then.
Sir Jorah is now in Pentos, anxious to earn a royal pardon that would allow him to return from exile, Robert explained. Lord Varys makes good use of him.
So the slaver has become a spy, Ned said with distaste. He handed the letter back. I would rather he become a corpse.
Varys tells me that spies are more useful than corpses, Robert said. Jorah aside, what do you make of his report?
Daenerys Targaryen has wed some Dothraki horselord. What of it? Shall we send her a wedding gift? The king frowned.
A knife, perhaps. A good sharp one, and a bold man to wield it.
Ned did not feign surprise. Robert's hatred of the Targaryens was a madness in him. He remembered the angry words they had exchanged when Tywin Lannister had presented Robert with the corpses of Rhaegar's wife and children as a token of fealty. Ned had named that murder. Robert called it war. When he had protested that the young prince and princess were no more than babes, his new-made king had replied, "I see no babes, only dragonspawn." Not even John Arryn had been able to calm that storm. Eddard Stark had ridden out that very day in a cold rage to fight the last battles of the war alone in the south. It had taken another death to reconcile them, Lyanna's death, and the grief they shared over her passing. This time, Ned resolved to keep his temper. "Your Grace, the girl is scarcely more than a child. You are no Tywin Lannister, to slaughter innocents." It was said that Rhaegar's little girl had cried as they dragged her from beneath her bed to face the swords. The boy had been no more than a babe in arms, yet Lord Tywin's soldiers had torn him from his mother's breast and dashed his head against a wall.
"And how long will this one remain, an innocent?" Robert's mouth grew hard. "This child will soon enough spread her legs and start breeding more dragonspawn to plague me."
"Nonetheless," Ned said, "the murder of children, it would be vile, unspeakable."
"Unspeakable?" the king roared. "What Ares did to your brother Brandon was unspeakable. The way your lord father died, that was unspeakable. And Rhaegar? How many times do you think he raped your sister? How many hundreds of times?"
His voice had grown so loud that his horse whinnied nervously beneath him. The king jerked the reins hard, quieting the animal, and pointed an angry finger at Ned.
"I will kill every Targaryen I can lay my hands on, until they are as dead as their dragons, and then I will piss on their graves."
Ned knew better than to defy him when the wrath was on him. If the years had not quenched Robert's thirst for revenge, no words of his would help. "You can't get your hands on this one, can you?" he said quietly. The king's mouth twisted in a bitter grimace.
"No, gods be caused. Some pox-ridden Pentoshi cheesemonger had her brother and her walled up on his estate, with pointy-hatted eunuchs all around them. And now he's handed them over to the Dothraki. I should have had them both killed years ago, when it was easy to get at them. But John was as bad as you. More fool I listened to him."
"John Arryn was a wise man and a good hand." Robert snorted. The anger was leaving him as suddenly as it had come.
"This Khal Drogo is said to have 100,000 men in his horde. What would John say to that?"
"He would say that even 1,000,000 Dothraki are no threat to the realm, so long as they remain on the other side of the narrow sea," Ned replied calmly. "The barbarians have no ships. They hate and fear the open sea." The king shifted uncomfortably in his saddle.
Perhaps. There are ships to be had in the free cities, though. I tell you, Ned, I do not like this marriage. There are still those in the Seven Kingdoms who call me a usurper. Do you forget how many houses fought for Targaryen in the war? They bide their time for now, but give them half a chance. They will murder me in my bed, and my sons with me. If the beggar king crosses with a Dothraki horde at his back, the traitors will join him.
He will not cross, Ned promised. And if by some mischance he does, we will throw him back into the sea. Once you choose a new warden of the east... The king groaned.
For the last time, I will not name the Aaron boy warden. I know that boy's a nephew, but with Targaryens climbing in bed with Dothraki, I would be mad to rest one quarter of the realm on the shoulders of a sickly child.
Ned was ready for that. Yet we still must have a warden of the east. If Robert Aaron will not do, name one of your brothers. Stannis proved himself at the siege of Storm's End, surely. He let the name hang there for a moment. The king frowned and said nothing. He looked uncomfortable. That is, Ned finished, quietly, watching, unless you have already promised the honour to another. For a moment, Robert had the grace to look startled. Just as quickly, the look became annoyance.
What have I have?
It's Jaime Lannister, is it not? Robert kicked his horse back into motion and started down the ridge toward the barrows. Ned kept pace with him. The king rode on, eyes straight ahead.
Yes, he said at last,
a single hard word to end the matter. Kingslayer, Ned said. The rumors were true then. He rode on dangerous ground now, he knew. An able and courageous man, no doubt, he said carefully, but his father is warden of the West, Robert. In time, Sir Jaime will succeed to that honour. No one man should hold both east and west. He left unsaid his real concern, that the appointment would put half the armies of the realm into the hands of the Lannisters. "I will fight that battle when the enemy appears on the field," the king said stubbornly.
"At the moment Lord Tywin looms eternal as Casterly Rock, so I doubt that Jaime will be succeeding any time soon. Don't vex me about this, Ned. The stone has been set."
"Your Grace, may I speak frankly?"
"I seem unable to stop you," Robert grumbled.
They rode through tall brown grasses. "Can you trust Jaime Lannister?"
"He is my wife's twin, a sworn brother of the King's Guard. His life and fortune and honour are all bound to mine."
"As they were bound to Aerys Targaryen," Ned pointed out.
"Why should I mistrust him? He's done everything I've ever asked of him. His sword helped me win the throne I sit on."
"His sword helped taint the throne you sit on," Ned thought, but he did not permit the words to pass his lips. He swore a vow to protect his king's life with his own. Then he opened that king's throat with a sword.
"Seven hells! Someone had to kill Aerys,"
Robert said, reining his mount to a sudden halt beside an ancient barrow.
"If Jaime hadn't done it, it would have been left for you, or me."
"We were not sworn brothers of the King's Guard," Ned said. The time had come for Robert to hear the whole truth. He decided then and there. "Do you remember the trident, Your Grace?"
"I won my crown there. How should I forget it?"
"You took a wound from Rhaegar," Ned reminded him. "So when the Targaryen hosts broke and ran, you gave the pursuit into my hands. The remnants of Rhaegar's army fled back to King's Landing. We followed. Aerys was in the Red Keep with several thousand loyalists. I expected to find the gates closed to us." Robert gave an impatient shake of his head.
"Instead, you found that our men had already taken the city. What of it?"
"Not our men," Ned said patiently. "Lannister men. The line of Lannister flew above the ramparts, not the crown stag. And they had taken the city by treachery." The war had raged for close to a year. Lords great and small had flocked to Robert's banners. Others had remained loyal to Targaryen. the mighty Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Wardens of the West, had remained aloof from the struggle, ignoring calls to arms from both rebels and royalists. Aerys Targaryen must have thought that his guards had answered his prayers when Lord Tywin Lannister appeared before the gates of King's Landing with an army 12,000 strong, professing loyalty. So the Mad King had ordered his last mad act. He had opened his city to the lions at the gate.
"Treachery was a coin the Targaryens knew well," Robert said. The anger was building in him again. "Lannister paid them back in kind. It was no less than they deserved. I shall not trouble my sleep over it."
"You were not there," Ned said, bitterness in his voice. Trouble sleep was no stranger to him. It lived his lies for 14 years, that they still haunted him at night. "There was no honour in that conquest."
"The others take your honour," Robert swore. "What did Targaryen ever know of honour? Go down into your crypt and ask Lyanna about the dragon's honour."
"You avenge Lyanna at the Triton," Ned said, halting beside the king. "Promise me, Ned," she had whispered.
"That did not bring her back."
Robert looked away, off into the grey distance.
"The gods be damned. It was a hollow victory they gave me. A crown. It was a girl I prayed them for. Your sister, safe, and mine again. She was meant to be. I asked you, Ned, what good is it to wear a crown? The gods mock the prayers of kings and cowards alike."
"I cannot answer for the gods, Your Grace, only for what I found when I rode into the throne room that day," Ned said. "Aerys was dead on the floor, drowned in his own blood. His dragon skull stared down from the walls. Lannister's men were everywhere. Jaime wore the white cloak of the King's Guard over his golden armour. I can see him still. Even his sword was gilded. He was seated on the Iron Throne, high above his knights, wearing a helm fashioned in the shape of a lion's head. How he glittered!"
"This is well known," the king complained.
"I was still mounted. I rode the length of the hall in silence, between the long rows of dragon skulls. It felt as though they were watching me somehow. I stopped in front of the throne, looking up at him. His golden sword was across his legs, its edge red with the king's blood. My men were filling the room behind me. Lannister's men drew back. I never said a word. I looked at him, seated there on the throne, and I waited. At last, Jaime laughed and got up. He took off his helm, and he said to me, 'Have no fear, Stark. I was only keeping it warm for our friend Robert. It's not a very comfortable seat, I'm afraid.' The king threw back his head and roared. His laughter startled a flight of crows from the tall brown grass. They took to the air in a wild beating of wings. 'You think I should mistrust Lannister, because he sat on my throne for a few minutes, eh?'" He shook with laughter again. "Jaime was all of 17, Ned. Scarce more than a boy."
"Boy or man, he had no right to that throne." "Perhaps he was tired," Robert suggested. "Killing kings is weary work. Gods know there's no place else to rest your ass in that damnable room." "And he spoke truly. It is a monstrous, uncomfortable chair, in more ways than one."
The king shook his head.
"Well, now I know Jaime's dark sin, and the matter can be forgotten. I'm heartily sick of secrets and squabbles and matters of state, Ned. It's all as tedious as counting coppers. Come, let's ride. You used to know how. I want to feel the wind in me hair again."
He kicked his horse back into motion and galloped up over the barrow, raining earth down behind him. For a moment, Ned did not follow. He had run out of words, and he was filled with a vast sense of
helplessness.
Not for the first time he wondered what he was doing here, and why he had come. He was no John Aaron, to curb the wildness of his king and teach him wisdom. Robert would do what he pleased, as he always had, and nothing Ned could say or do would change that. He belonged in Winterfell. He belonged with Catelyn, in her grief, and with Bran. A man could not always be where he belonged, though. Resigned, Eddard Stark put his boots into his horse and set off after the king. Tyrion. The north went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another. They had left Winterfell on the same day as the king, amidst all the commotion of the royal departure, riding out to the sound of men shouting and horses snorting, to the rattle of wagons and the groaning of the queen's huge wheelhouse as a light snow flurried about them. The king's road was just beyond the sprawl of castle and town. There the banners and the wagons and the columns of knights and free-riders turned south, taking the tumult with them, while Tyrion turned north with Benjen Stark and his nephew. It had grown colder after that, and far more quiet. West of the road were flint hills, grey and rugged, with tall watchtowers on their stony summits. To the east the land was lower, the ground flattening to a rolling plain that stretched away as far as the eye could see. Stone bridges spanned swift, narrow rivers, while small farms spread in rings around holdfasts, walled in wood and stone. The road was well trafficked, and at night, for their comfort, there were rude inns to be found. 3 days' ride from Winterfell, however, the farmland gave way to dense wood, and the King's Road grew lonely. The flint hills rose higher and wilder with each passing mile, until by the fifth day they had turned into mountains, cold blue-grey giants with jagged promontories and snow on their shoulders. When the wind blew from the north, long plumes of ice crystals flew from the high peaks like banners. With the mountains, a wall to the west, the road veered north by northeast, through the wood, a forest of oak and evergreen and black briar that seemed older and darker than any Tyrion had ever seen. The Wolf's Wood, Benjen Stark called it, and indeed their nights came alive with the howls of distant packs, and some not so distant. Jon Snow's albino direwolf pricked up his ears at the nightly howling, but never raised his own voice in reply. There was something very unsettling about that animal, Tyrion thought. There were eight in the party by then, not counting the wolf. Tyrion travelled with two of his own men, as befit a Lannister. Benjen Stark had only his bastard nephew and some fresh mounts for the night's watch, but at the edge of the Wolf's Wood they stayed a night behind the wooden walls of a forest holdfast, and there joined up with another of the Black Brothers, one Yoren. Yoren was stooped and sinister, his features hidden behind a beard as black as his clothing, but he seemed as tough as an old root and as hard as stone. With him were a pair of ragged peasant boys from the Fingers.
"Rapers,"
Yoren said, with a cold look at his charges. Tyrion understood. Life on the Wall was said to be hard, but no doubt it was preferable to castration. Five men, three boys, a direwolf, 20 horses, and a cage of ravens given over to Benjen Stark by Maester Luwin. No doubt they made a curious fellowship for the King's Road, or any road. Tyrion noticed Jon Snow watching Yoren and his sullen companions, with an odd cast to his face that looked uncomfortably like dismay. Yoren had a twisted shoulder and a sour smell. His hair and his beard were matted and greasy and full of lice. His clothing, old, patched, and seldom washed. His two young recruits smelled even worse, and seemed as stupid as they were cruel. No doubt the boy had made the mistake of thinking that the Night's Watch was made up of men like his uncle. If so, Yoren and his companions were a rude awakening. Tyrion felt sorry for the boy. He had chosen a hard life. Or perhaps he should say that a hard life had been chosen for him. He had rather less sympathy for the uncle. Benjamin Stark seemed to share his brother's distaste for the Lannisters, and he had not been pleased when Tyrion had told him of his intentions. "I warn you, Lannister, you'll find no ends at the wall," he had said, looking down at him.
"No doubt you'll find some place to put me," Tyrion had replied. "As you might have noticed, I'm small."
One did not say no to the Queen's brother, of course. So that had settled the matter. But Stark had not been happy. "You will not like the ride, I promise you that," he said curtly, and since the moment they set out, he had done all he could to live up to that promise. By the end of the first week, Tyrion's thighs were raw from hard riding, his legs were cramping badly, and he was chilled to the bone. He did not complain. He was damned if he would give Benjamin Stark that satisfaction. He took a small revenge in the matter of his riding fur, a tattered bearskin, old and musty-smelling. Stark had offered it to him in an excess of Night's Watch gallantry, no doubt expecting him to graciously decline. Tyrion had accepted with a smile. He had brought his warmest clothing with him when they rode out of Winterfell, and soon discovered that it was nowhere near warm enough. It was cold up here, and growing colder. The nights were well below freezing now, and when the wind blew, it was like a knife cutting right through his warmest woolens. By now Stark was no doubt regretting his chivalrous impulse. Perhaps he had learned a lesson. The Lannisters never declined, graciously or otherwise. The Lannisters took what was offered. Farms and holdfasts grew scarcer and smaller as they pressed northward, ever deeper into the darkness of the Wolf's Wood, until finally there were no more roofs to shelter under, and they were thrown back on their own resources. Tyrion was never much use in making a camp or breaking one. Too small, too hobbled, too in the way. So while Stark and Yoren and the other men erected rude shelters, tended to horses, and built a fire, it became his custom to take his fur and a wineskin and go off by himself to read. On the 18th night of their journey, the wine was a rare, sweet amber from the summer isles that he had brought all the way north from Casterly Rock, and the book a rumination on the history and properties of dragons. With Lord Eddard Stark's permission, Tyrion had borrowed a few rare volumes from the Winterfell library and packed them for the ride north. He found a comfortable spot just beyond the noise of the camp, beside a swift-running stream with waters clear and cold as ice. A grotesquely ancient oak provided shelter from the biting wind. Tyrion curled up in his fur, with his back against the trunk, took a sip of the wine, and began to read about the properties of dragonbone. "Dragonbone is black because of its high iron content," the book told him. "It is strong as steel, yet lighter and far more flexible, and of course utterly impervious to fire. Dragonbone bows are greatly prized by the Dothraki, and small wonder. An archer so armed can outrange any wooden bow." Tyrion had a morbid fascination with dragons. When he had first come to King's Landing for his sister's wedding to Robert Baratheon, he had made it a point to seek out the dragon skulls that had hung on the walls of Targaryen's throne room. King Robert had replaced them with banners and tapestries, but Tyrion had persisted until he found the skulls in the dank cellar where they had been stored. He had expected to find them impressive, perhaps even frightening. He had not thought to find them beautiful. Yet they were, as black as onyx, polished smooth, so the bones seemed to shimmer in the light of his torch. They liked the fire, he sensed. He thrust the torch into the mouth of one of the larger skulls and made the shadows leap and dance on the wall behind him. The teeth were long, curving knives of black diamond. The flame of the torch was nothing to them. They had bathed in the heat of far greater fires. When he had moved away, Tyrion could have sworn that the beast's empty eye sockets had watched him go. There were 19 skulls. The oldest was more than 3,000 years old, the youngest a mere century and a half. The most recent were also the smallest. A match pair no bigger than mastiff skulls, and oddly misshapen. All that remained of the last two hatchlings born on Dragonstone. They were the last of the Targaryen dragons. Perhaps the last dragons anywhere. And they had not lived very long. From there, the skulls ranged upward in size to the three great monsters of song and story, the dragons that Aegon Targaryen and his sisters had unleashed on the Seven Kingdoms of old. The singers had given them the names of gods, Balerion, Meraxes, Vhagar. Tyrion had stood between their gaping jaws, wordless and awed. You could have ridden a horse down Vhagar's gullet, although you would not have ridden it out again. Meraxes was even bigger, and the greatest of them all, Balerion the Black Dread, could have swallowed an auric hole, or even one of the hairy mammoths said to roam the cold waste beyond the port of Ibn. Tyrion stood in a dank cellar for a long time, staring at Balerion's huge, empty-eyed skull, until his torch burned low, trying to grasp the size of the living animal, and to imagine how it must have looked when it spread its great black wings and swept across the skies, breathing fire. His own remote ancestor, King Loran of the Rock, had tried to stand against the fire when he joined with King Mern of the Reach to oppose the Targaryen conquest. That was close on 300 years ago, when the Seven Kingdoms were kingdoms, and not mere provinces of a greater realm. Between them, the two kings had 600 banners flying, 5,000 mounted knights, and 10 times as many free riders and men-at-arms. Aegon Dragonlord had perhaps a fifth of that number, the chronicler said, and most of those were conscripts from the ranks of the last king he had slain, their loyalties uncertain. The host met on the broad plains of the Reach, amidst golden fields of wheat ripe for harvest. When the two kings charged, the Targaryen army shivered and shattered and began to run. For a few moments, the chroniclers wrote, the conquest was at an end. But only for those few moments, before Aegon Targaryen and his sisters joined the battle. It was the only time that Vhagar, Meraxes, and Balerion were all unleashed at once. The singers called it the Field of Fire. Near 4,000 men had burned that day, among them King Mern of the Reach. King Loran had escaped and lived long enough to surrender, pledge his fealty to the Targaryens, and beget a son, for which Tyrion was duly grateful. "Why do you read so much?" Tyrion looked up at the sound of the voice. Jon Snow was standing a few feet away, regarding him curiously. He closed the book on a finger and said, "Look at me, and tell me what you see." The boy looked at him suspiciously. "Is this some kind of trick? I see you, Tyrion Lannister." Tyrion sighed. "Oh, you are remarkably polite for a bastard, Snow. What you see is a dwarf. You are what, 12?
14, the boy said.
14! And you're taller than I will ever be.
My legs are short and twisted, and I walk with difficulty. I require a special saddle to keep me from falling off my horse. A saddle of my own design, you may be interested to know. It was either that or ride a pony. My arms are strong enough, but again, too short. I will never make a swordsman. Had I been born a peasant, they might have left me out to die or sold me to some slaver's grotesquerie. Alas, I was born a Lannister of Casterly Rock, and the grotesqueries are all the poorer. Things are expected of me. My father was the hand of the king for 20 years. My brother later killed that very same king, as it turns out, but life is full of these little ironies. My sister married the new king, and my repulsive nephew will be king after him. I must do my part for the honour of my house. Wouldn't you agree? Yet how? Well, my legs may be too small for my body, but my head is too large. Although I prefer to think it's just large enough for my mind. I have a realistic grasp of my own strengths and weaknesses. My mind is my weapon. My brother has his sword, King Robert has his war hammer, and I have my mind. And a mind needs books, as a sword needs a whetstone, if it is to keep its edge. Tyrion tapped the leather cover of the book. That's why I read so much, Jon Snow. The boy absorbed that all in silence. He had the stark face, if not the name. Long, solemn, guarded, a face that gave nothing away. Whoever his mother had been, she had left little of herself in her son. "What are you reading about?" he asked.
"Dragons," Tyrion told him. "What good is that? There are no more dragons," the boy said with the easy certainty of youth.
"So they say," Tyrion replied. "Sad, isn't it? When I was your age, I used to dream of having a dragon of my own."
"You did?" the boy said suspiciously. Perhaps he thought Tyrion was making fun of him.
"Oh, yes. Even a stunted, twisted, ugly little boy can look down over the world when he's seated on a dragon's back." Tyrion pushed the bearskin aside and climbed to his feet. "I used to start fires in the bowels of Casterly Rock and stare at the flames for hours, pretending they were dragon fire. Sometimes I'd imagine my father burning. At other times, my sister."
Jon Snow was staring at him, a look equal parts horror and fascination. Tyrion guffawed.
Don't look at me that way, bastard. I know your secret. You've dreamt the same kind of dreams."
"No." Jon Snow was horrified. "I wouldn't."
"No? Never?"
Tyrion raised an eyebrow.
"Well, no doubt the Starks have been terribly good to you. I'm certain Lady Stark treats you as if you were one of her own. And your brother Rob, he's always been kind, and why not? He gets Winterfell, and you get the Wall. And your father, he must have good reasons for packing you off to the Night's Watch."
"Stop it," Jon Snow said, his face dark with anger. "The Night's Watch is a noble calling." Tyrion laughed.
"You're too smart to believe that. The Night's Watch is a midden heap for all the misfits of the realm. I've seen you looking at Yoren and his boys. Those are your new brothers, Jon Snow. How'd you like them, Sullen peasants, debtors, poachers, rapers, thieves, and bastards like you all wind up on the Wall, watching for Grumpkins and Snarks and all the other monsters your wet nurse warned you about. The good part is, there are no Grumpkins or Snarks, so it's scarcely dangerous work. The bad part is that you freeze your balls off. But since you're not allowed to breed anywhere, I don't suppose that matters."
"Stop it!" the boy screamed. He took a step forward, his hands coiling into fists close to Tyr's. Suddenly, absurdly, Tyrion felt guilty. He took a step forward, intending to give the boy a reassuring pat on the shoulder or mutter some word of apology. He never saw the wolf, where it was, or how it came at him. One moment he was walking towards Snow, and the next he was flat on his back on a hard, rocky ground, the book spinning away from him as he fell, the breath going out of him at the sudden impact, his mouth full of dirt and blood and rotting leaves. As he tried to get up, his back spasmed painfully. He must have wrenched it in the fall. He ground his teeth in frustration, grabbed a root, pulled himself back to a sitting position. "Help me!" he said to the boy, reaching up a hand. And suddenly the wolf was between them. He did not growl. The damn thing never made a sound. He only looked at him with those bright red eyes and showed him his teeth, and that was more than enough. Tyrion sagged back to the ground with a grunt. "Don't help me, then. I'll sit right here until you leave." Jon Snow stroked Ghost's thick white fur, smiling now. "Ask me nicely." Tyrion Lannister felt the anger coiling inside him and crushed it out with a will. It was not the first time in his life he had been humiliated, and it would not be the last. Perhaps he even deserved this. "I should be very grateful for your kind assistance, Jon," he said mildly. "Down, Ghost," the boy said. The direwolf sat on his haunches. Those red eyes never left Tyrion. Jon came around behind him, slid his hands under his arms, and lifted him easily to his feet. Then he picked up the book and handed it back. "Why did he attack me?" Tyrion asked, with a sidelong glance at the direwolf. He wiped blood and dirt from his mouth with the back of his hand. "Maybe he thought you were a Grumpkin." Tyrion glanced at him sharply. Then he laughed, a short snort of amusement that came bursting out through his nose entirely without his permission. "Oh, gods," he said, choking on his laughter and shaking his head, "I suppose I do rather look like a Grumpkin. What does he do to Snarks?" "You don't want to know." Jon picked up the wineskin and handed it to Tyrion. Tyrion pulled out the stopper, tilted his head, and squeezed a long stream into his mouth. The wine was cold fire as it trickled down his throat and warmed his belly. He held out the skin to Jon Snow. "Want some?" The boy took the skin and tried a cautious swallow. "It's true, isn't it?" he said when he was done. "What you said about the Night's Watch?" Tyrion nodded. Jon Snow set his mouth in a grim line. "If that's what it is, that's what it is." Tyrion grinned at him. "That's good, Bastard. Most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it." "Most men," the boy said, "but not you."
"No," Tyrion admitted, "not me. I seldom ever dream of dragons any more. There are no dragons."
He scooped up his fallen bearskin.
"Come, we'd better return to camp before your uncle calls the banners."
The walk back was short, but the ground was rough underfoot, and his legs were cramping badly by the time they got back. Jon Snow offered a hand to help him over a thick tangle of roots, but Tyrion shook him off. He would make his own way, as he had all his life. Still, the camp was a welcome sight. The shelters had been thrown up against the tumble-down wall of a long-abandoned holdfast, a shield against the wind. The horses had been fed, and a fire had been laid. Yoren sat on a stone, skinning a squirrel. The savory smell of stew filled Tyrion's nostrils. He dragged himself over to where his man Morrick was tending the stewpot. Wordlessly, Morrick handed him the ladle. Tyrion tasted and handed it back.
"More pepper," he said.
Benjen Stark emerged from the shelter he shared with his nephew.
"There you are, Jon, damn it. Don't go off like that by yourself. I thought the others had gotten you."
"It was the Grumpkins," Tyrion told him, laughing.
Jon Snow smiled. Stark shot a baffled look at Yoren. The old man grunted, shrugged, and went back to his bloody work. The squirrel gave some body to the stew, and they ate it with black bread and hard cheese that night around their fire. Tyrion shared around his skin of wine, until even Yoren grew mellow. One by one, the company drifted off to their shelters and to sleep, all but Jon Snow, who had drawn the night's first watch. Tyrion was the last to retire, as always. As he stepped into the shelter his men had built for him, he paused and looked back at Jon Snow. The boy stood near the fire, his face still and hard, looking deep into the flames. Tyrion Lannister smiled sadly and went to bed. Catelyn. Ned and the girls were 8 days gone when Maester Luwin came to her one night in Bran's sick room, carrying a reading lamp and the books of account.
"It's past time that we reviewed the figures, my lady," he said. "You'll want to know how much the royal visit cost us."
Catelyn looked at Bran in his sick bed and brushed his hair back off his forehead. It had grown very long, she realized. She would have to cut it soon. "I have no need to look at figures, Maester Luwin," she told him, never taking her eyes from Bran. "I know what the visit cost us. Take the books away."
"My lady, the king's party had healthy appetites. We must replenish our stores before—" She cut him off.
"I said take the books away. The steward will attend to our needs."
"We have no steward," Maester Luwin reminded her. Like a little grey rat, she thought, he would not let go. "Poole went south to establish Lord Eddard's household at King's Landing."
Catelyn nodded absently. "Oh, yes, I remember." Bran looked so pale. She wondered whether she might move his bed onto the window so he could get the morning sun. Maester Luwin set the lamp in a niche by the door and fiddled with its wick.
"There are several appointments that require your immediate attention, my lady. Besides the steward, we need a captain of the guards to fill Jory's place. A new master of horse."
Her eyes snapped around and found him.
"A master of horse?"
Her voice was a whip. The maester was shaken.
"Yes, my lady. Hullan rode south with Lord Eddard, so—"
"My son lies here, broken and dying, Luwin, and you wish to discuss a new master of horse? Do you think I care what happens in the stables? Do you think it matters to me one whit? I would gladly butcher every horse in Winterfell with my own hands if it would open Bran's eyes. Do you understand that? Do you?" He bowed his head.
"Yes, my lady, but the appointments—"
"I'll make the appointments," Rob said. Catelyn had not heard him enter, but there he stood in the doorway, looking at her. She had been shouting, she realized, with a sudden flush of shame. What was happening to her? She was so tired, and her head hurt all the time. Maester Luwin looked from Catelyn to her son.
"I have prepared a list of those we might wish to consider for the vacant offices," he said, offering Rob a paper plucked from his sleeve.
Her son glanced at the names. He had come from outside, Catelyn saw. His cheeks were red from the cold, his hair shaggy and windblown. "Good men," he said. "We'll talk about them tomorrow." He handed back the list of names.
"Very good, my lord."
The paper vanished into his sleeve. "Leave us now," Rob said. Maester Luwin bowed and departed. Rob closed the door behind him and turned to her. He was wearing a sword, she saw. "Mother, what are you doing?" Catelyn had always thought Rob looked like her, like Bran and Rickon and Sansa. He had the Tully colouring, the auburn hair, the blue eyes. Yet now for the first time she saw something of Eddard Stark in his face, something as stern and hard as the North. "What am I doing?" she echoed, puzzled. "How can you ask that? What do you imagine I'm doing?"